Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Ciao, Bellas, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And by my side is the one and only Mr. Gabe Haggard.
Hello.
Hello. Hey, Gabe.
Yes.
Do you realize it's our 10th anniversary?
I did not realize that. I do realize that now. However, I did not bring you a gift.
No? You know, no. Hallmark says diamonds are an appropriate gift for a 10-year anniversary.
Did Hallmark say that? I think I would feel that Hallmark would be pushing stationery more than
that's sort of
diamonds.
Their MO, but in addition to cards, they also want you to buy diamonds.
Okay, I'll get back to you.
Okay, cool. Okay, so in lieu of diamonds, we're marking the occasion by bringing back a very special guest. That's right, the Biffle's back! It's the return of Miss Julianne Martin. Say hi, Julianne.
Hi, who's Master P?
Listeners will recall that on Julianne's last appearance, she relentlessly skewered F.W. Murnau's A Song of Two Humans.
It wasn't relentless.
Find out how well the number 10 film on the Sight and Sound poll, Federico Fellini's 8.5, holds up under her incisive and fearless critical eye.
I relented.
It was so relentless that we needed to do, like, a retraction on the next episode, apologizing for how ruthlessly we had attacked A Tale of Two Humans.
F.W. Murnau was spinning in his grave.
Absolutely. And poor Federico won't know what hit him. We're going to follow that up with a discussion about how pieces of culture grow or diminish in our esteem as we get older. Then in order to recover from all the tongue-lashing that is no doubt in store for us, we're going to end with a final note of positivity.
Wait, who's going to be lashing?
Julianne.
Julianne,
I'm not going to be lashing. I like the movie.
Sure. For our first topic, we're going to discuss the number 10 movie on the Sight and Sound list of greatest movies of all time, Federico Fellini's 8.5 film, 8.5. 8.5 is an epic space picture filled with romance, adventure, extraterrestrials, and profound allegories about the unknowability of the universe. Or rather, it would tell the story of a grand space opera, if only the director could get his act together. But instead, we get a story of a director, played by Marcello Mastroianni, who's racked with guilt and anxiety because he can't come up with a story for his next film. A film, by the way, which is already in the advanced stages of pre-production. He's got his actors, he's built a giant set, but he's got no script. But through the course of the actual film that we are watching, not the film within a film, our protagonist's anxiety has him falling deeper and deeper into the realm of fantasy as he tries desperately to put his life and his movie together before production starts. Okay, guys, what'd you think of the movie? We'll start with Gabe.
I really enjoyed watching it. It was one of those films that I would not necessarily have watched it if it was not on this list that we're going through. But there are aspects of it that were really, really cool. I loved the cinematography. I loved his use of sort of like a depth of field and his juxtaposition of background and foreground. So I found myself throughout the majority of the movie really being engaged by the imagery. Yeah, I liked it.
All right, Julianne.
I didn't enjoy it. Like, I didn't enjoy the experience of watching it as much. And this is in part just a technical thing. I don't love watching films in other languages because so much of the visuals you can't look at because you're looking at the bottom of the screen and you're looking at the translation. And also, thanks a lot, Amazon Instant Video, but the dialogue was so fast-paced that a lot of the time I couldn't read the titles fast enough, which was really frustrating to me. But that was, I guess, maybe unique to my experience. But
I felt the same way, and I just felt that it was something that I had to deal with. It was not ideal. Like, at that point, my laziness kicked in, and I was like, well, I'm not going to go out and learn Italian.
Yeah,
right.
The dialogue is really dense, and also the writer/critic that's always hounding him and telling him how off he is, I think a lot of his dialogue is supposed to kind of
fly by you. It's just supposed to be incessant negativity.
Well, that's the thing. Like, a lot of, there were a lot of intermingled voices and a lot of people talking at once, which really created this, like, palpable sense of anxiety, but at the same time was really hard when you're reading it, because it's like, I don't know where these are coming from. I had a hard time keeping track of who was who, in part because all of his beautiful Italian actresses kind of look the same, but also because, you know, they just, those voices all blend together. But beyond that, because, you know, it is sort of a necessary evil of, like, consuming something that was made originally in another language, it's kind of a cold movie. Like, it's in black and white. The images are really, really stark and beautiful, but also, like, have a lot of really terrifying subject matter, and a lot of the dream sequences and fantasy sequences are so scary. Like, the framing, the camera movements, it just feels very, like, cold and predatory almost. I don't even know how to explain it, but, like, the fantasy where he's with his parents out in the field, it's spooky. Yeah. Like, the sound is so it's this, like, ambient noise, and I felt creeped out for a lot of it.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that is an absolutely the appropriate reaction to have. I mean, the scene where he goes and visits the cardinal, it's not entirely clear whether it's a fantasy sequence. It probably is, but he's literally, it feels like he's descending into hell with the cardinal. And, like, there's mud there that looks like lava. It's creepy. But for me, when I first saw this movie, I was in love. I fell in love with this movie. To me, it so accurately depicted the anxiety that comes with feeling like you have a deadline and nothing to show for, and people hounding you and nothing to show for it. And as a filmmaker, it particularly struck that chord, and it was so heartening to feel like even Fellini gets anxiety and gets, you know, writer's block or director's block, that was very reassuring to me as a young person. And the surreal elements totally blew my mind. So basically I like it. So, but this is actually a bit of a departure for Fellini. Prior to this film and La Dolce Vita, he was primarily known for more of the neorealist style that was very typical of Italian cinema at the time. Films like La Strada and Knights of Cabiria, more of the realist style. But this film really, really indulges that fantastical side, the side that's into, was reading up on Carl Jung, you know. And also, it's really where he developed that Baroque style that he's so known for. So, but was that a turnoff for you? Did you enjoy that in this instance? Did his style intrigue you, or was it off-putting?
This is where I start to, I mean, I enjoyed watching the film. However, I felt that kind of what you were talking about, that it's kind of dark and you know, a cold film, and it's basically this man unraveling. You're witnessing a man unravel, and so where I found it falling short, or where I took issue with it, is that I didn't feel empathy for him. I felt sympathy, if not at times disdain. For him and his actions.
Interesting.
I started feeling like pity at times when he's struggling specifically with his wife and his mistress. And he starts to get, like, all kind of, like, bent out of shape, you know, and he's all kind of like, oh, you know, come on, you know, like, arguing with his wife.
Yeah.
And it was like, at that point, I was like, look, dude, you're a total dirtbag, you know? And then what kind of got me out of that and kind of put me in this really weird place was that whole fantasy about him with his harem,
right?
You know, and that was so ridiculous that it was no longer like pity, but it was just kind of like,
yeah, almost, it becomes humorous.
Well, almost in the way that he's kind of smirking right before he goes into that fantasy. I felt there was a tacit acknowledgement on his side that it was not really realistic, right? You know, and not, you know, wouldn't really be happening.
Right. He even kind of directly comments on that when he goes out with Claudia towards the end of the film. And he's describing the movie to her, but, you know, it's about him. He's describing himself. And they come to the conclusion that he's not a sympathetic character and that these problems are of his own doing.
That's absolutely true. But did you guys think it was funny?
Yes, it had this funny moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, like, that sequence definitely, like, got humorous.
Right.
But at the same time, why I didn't like it was because, I don't know, I guess ultimately at the end of the film, there wasn't as much resolution as I would have liked.
Right. I mean,
either way.
But I think that he is asking us, and he's asking his wife to accept him for who he is, as this dirtbag, and he is also asking us, the audience, to accept him as this dirtbag. To me, the fact that he can acknowledge it and that he's clearly making a joke out of it somehow makes it more acceptable for me. However, I don't want to let him off the hook because he's clearly a sexist pig.
Well, it makes him more palatable, mm-hmm. in a sense. It makes him endearing, but not empathetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so I never got to the point I felt like that I was on his side,
mm-hmm.
or rather that he was just, you know, an idiot. You know?
I actually did feel on his side a lot. I empathized with him in a number of cases. Mostly, I think I related to, there were so many scenes with, like, crowds of people buzzing around him, asking him for things and wanting things from him. And it seemed like he just didn't really have that much, you know, control is in his own life to that extent, and I really related to that and felt terrible for him.
Yeah,
as did I. And again, to bring up the moment when that started going off the tracks for me was when his mistress shows up at the cafe, and I thought that shot was like brilliant when she the mistress like steps out of the car and like takes a couple steps forward and then isn't sure what to do. Turns around, is going to walk away, you know, and yeah. just like stumbled, you know, that was hilarious. That was awesome. But it was in that scene that I felt that he lost me as far as empathy goes.
So anyone who knows me, I feel like Julianne can attest to this. I am an anxious person. So I felt a lot of empathy for Guido, especially when I first watched this, when I was probably 16. I don't know, I was a teenager when I first watched this. And it does such a great job of capturing what it's like to feel anxious, because Fellini's style in particular, where he's transitioning between the present and the past and these fantasy sequences, that so perfectly encapsulates what it's like to feel anxious, because one anxiety like seems to meld into another from the past, and then you worry about the future, and the style so suits that frame of mind. So I think in that sense, the style is really, really effective. However, as I've gotten older, I've sort of realized that people aren't knocking down my door waiting for my next masterpiece. So all the scenes where he's being hounded and beautiful women are throwing themselves at him and he kind of dismisses them out of hand, I find myself relating to those aspects of it less and less, which I guess is part of why I don't feel as strongly about the film as I used to. But so what do you guys think of Sarah Gina?
Well, I thought that his real issue with women is that he seems to regard a lot of them as whores, and a lot of his relationships with women kind of take on like a whore-ish aspect. Like, there are so many women that want things from him. There's like a transaction element to almost all of his relationships, and you know, even in the beginning of the film when he's with Carla, he's like, paint your eyebrows like you're a whore. It's like, it seems to be his thing. And that's primarily, I think, why he has this big disconnect with his wife, because he can't have that kind of relationship with her. And she wants, you know, an equal, respectful, mutually
right.
beneficial relationship. You know, between two adults who, like, love each other. And he is completely unable to have that with anyone.
And sometimes it's also, I feel some validation watching the movie, because sometimes it's funny to have your own worst fears about the way men desire women confirmed in movies, you know what I mean?
Hilarious.
Yes, it's funny. But okay, so to be fair, I most of the women in the movie are depicted as either, they're either like stupid or silly, with one or two exceptions. So women are perhaps treated unfairly in this movie. However, the men aren't treated all that much better. They're also seen as pathetic, stupid creatures as well. So everyone kind of gets an unfair shake here.
That's true. I feel bad for that dude who's just like, he's like, Guido, like, I'm not pathetic, right? I know that I'm 30 years older and that I left my wife on a whim and she was my daughter's school friend, but like, it's love, right? Yeah. Like, I'm good, right?
Right. So, Julianne, you mentioned Fellini's muse or Guido's muse, Claudia. I kept thinking throughout, like, if I were in his position, my muse would totally be one of those crazy middle-aged ladies.
That's not how men work.
No, I know. That's how I work. That's okay. I just want to say to all the middle-aged actresses out there, I need muses too.
Can I just say the scene in the harem where she's like, Guido, no, I was born in 1938. I'm only 26. It was so depressing because I am going to be 26 later this year. So that's the cutoff to go to the upper floor.
The attic.
Okay, but there's no way she was 26.
Right. She's in denial.
All right.
You're still young. We'll give you a
like
few 53. More years. She was at least 30. So
I will say that, you know, that all the women in the harem are like, Guido, you're not young either. You know, a man who cares about age would be, you know, a disgrace in France. But like, he's a pretty attractive older man.
He's so hot. Oh, my God.
Wow. All right.
I freaking love Guido.
I think pretty attractive is where I cap out with him.
Oh, my God. I love him and his sunglasses.
I like his silver streaks. Mm. He's a silver fox.
All right. So let's talk about the ending. Gabe, you had a theory about the ending.
Yeah, I have a theory. I mean, it's most likely incorrect and wrong, but the theory is, and I don't necessarily adhere to this theory, but the theory is that he kills himself. And the last scene is just another sort of fantasy of ultimately what he wanted. But with his behavior, the whole film was such that there's no way he could have gotten the resolution that he wanted. So at the press conference, when he crawls under the table, pulls out a gun, and shoots himself, he dies. And so the last scene where everybody comes and one big happy family is just a figment of his imagination. It's just sort of how he wishes things could have worked out. So I just thought, you know, this is like the resolution that he wanted, which is impossible because he's an idiot.
Why would he want all of those people back together? Like, they seem to all be suffocating him throughout the whole movie. I mean, even in the very beginning of the film, he's like flying away and then he gets pulled back down by these like throngs of people.
Right. Yeah. But I think
because he felt that they never accepted him. And so what the problem was is that he didn't know how to love others. And so he wanted them to all come back to him, but on his terms. And that's why ultimately that could never work, because his terms were absurd. Like the harem that he wanted was vaguely reminiscent of his flashback to childhood. So it's like this weird conglomeration of that, you know, how he's being bathed, and then he's being bathed in the harem.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point.
And so he wanted this all just to work out. And that was impossible. For me, it was sort of like a Judas character. In the Bible, Judas does acknowledge that he's done something terribly wrong by betraying Jesus, but he's not able to reconcile that. So similarly, Guido, in the end, realizes how bad he is and how destitute he is and how there's no hope for him. Or he thinks there's no hope for him, so he crawls under a table and kills himself.
Right. Judas kills himself too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, that casts everything in a very new light.
I certainly would have wanted to kill myself after that press conference. Good God.
And that was
the most nightmarish scene of the lot.
And that was sort of cathartic in a way for me, as I said, like, I empathized with him in the beginning, and the way that Fellini does Uncomfortable, like, so well. It was just, like, amazing. Like, I was sitting there watching, getting uncomfortable, you know, as, with him, like, trying to navigate, you know, through the sea of nonsense.
And then at the end, we have this reconciliation.
This theater. Sort of, yeah. Which is just exists in his Disneyland fantasy mind.
Complete with the kernel of music and everything. So, come to my last question. Question? Do you think
question.
Julianne, do you think it deserves its spot on the Sight and Sound poll? The number 10 greatest movie of all time.
Heck no, because it should be further up, because we already reviewed Sunrise, Song of Two Humans, and it's way better than that film. So, no.
All right.
No is my answer.
Perfect. Gabe, what do you think?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm trying to think of, like, I don't think I would put it any higher. Again, almost in a sense, so much of what I enjoyed about it was like the craftsmanship of it. And so I don't know that I would necessarily put it above, you know, Man with a Movie Camera or Joan of Arc, which, you know, kind of came before and were more revolutionary.
Mm.
I did enjoy this work and, you know, have made peace with my own understanding of how it possibly ended. So I'm going to say like a soft yes.
Okay, it's in its right place.
Soft yeah. yes.
Okay. I'm with Julianne. I think it should be higher because, as Julianne mentioned, it is below F. W. Murnau's A Song of Two Humans, Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. It's also below The Rules of the Game, which is a movie I don't like at all.
Okay, but this movie is also about a horrible man who treats women horribly.
That is true.
As was our grand, or like our biggest issue with the Song of Two Humans.
Right. What an interesting parallel.
Mm, but I think the difference is.
So,
no, so, it is. It's an interesting parallel.
No, maybe it just got juicy here at FlixWise Podcast.
I understand.
I hadn't
so,
even considered that.
For me, the fact that Fellini acknowledges the sexism is what differentiates it from Sunrise, the Song of Two Humans.
I also think 8.5 is a lot more complicated and nuanced. Like, the portrayals and the themes that it explores are really difficult subject matter and, like, addressed in a way that doesn't have any, like, clear resolution or way to tie it up, whereas I felt like Sunrise was cartoonish in its depiction of those characters.
I think it deserves to be higher on the list. Because this is a film that filmmakers love because it is about making movies.
Which actually I didn't like that much.
Okay.
Because I don't love media, like meta stories. I guess the most comparable film I could think of for 8.5 would be like Synecdoche, New York,
mm-hmm.
which came out in 2008. Charlie Kaufman mm-hmm. picture.
Yeah.
And that is a movie about a creative man trying to make a, you know, stage play that just kind of spirals out of control and turns into this, like, never-ending project, and he clearly has, like, no real idea. And I just generally, when I see, like, movies about making movies or TV shows about making movies, it's kind of like, guys, like, that's kind of a very isolated culture.
Right.
Like, we work, you know, I work in, like, kind of a Hollywood thing, like a cousin of Hollywood, and I work in animation, and, you know, we had, like, Mila Kunis in the studio the other day, and I'm like, you know, this
listen
is...
Listen to her name dropping, do you believe
Oh, my goodness, Mila Kunis. Let me do it again. you know, we've, it's the most Hollywood kind of job I've ever had, and it I think it kind of cuts you off from the rest of the world because most people don't work in making media and don't really care to and don't have much understanding of it. So I don't generally love stories that are about making stories. I feel like the best kinds of stories are the ones that I most enjoy watching, consuming, deal with some other subject matter.
But nevertheless, because filmmakers do really love films about filmmaking, believe it or not, filmmakers like to study their own
pat themselves yes. on the back from time to
time. Occasionally, they find filmmaking fascinating.
The
Go
craft.
Figure.
You must do anything for your craft.
So I think this movie is, not only is it great and compelling, but it's also, it's hugely influential. In addition to being fascinating, it's also, it has also influenced countless filmmakers. I feel like if you go to film school, half the people there are going to say that this is among their, you know, favorite movies.
That's what
I don't know about that. No. Well, film school, I feel like it's a lot of Woody Allen movies.
But Woody
like
Allen
Lost
loves,
in Translation.
Well, yeah, that's true. Woody Allen loves this movie, and Woody Allen was heavily influenced by Fellini. In fact, Stardust Memories is a direct tribute to 8 1/2.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah, all right. Bring well, in the knowledge. So, what?
You proved what? Me wrong.
Boom.
If I could drop this mic, I would. All right.
Our production budget prohibits
yeah.
that.
So for that reason, because of its influence, and because it is a groundbreaking work of cinema,
oh,
I think it is
ground.
So much ground.
To make that space structure.
Yeah. Oh, man. So I think it should be higher on the list, even if perhaps it doesn't speak to me the way that it once did when I was a teenager. As I mentioned in the previous segment, while I still really love 8 1/2, my passion for it has diminished over the years. I just don't relate to it in the same way that I used to. So this got me to thinking about how our tastes change over the years. As the sands in the hourglass go down, what we once counted as our favorite show, movie, and song falls out of favor. For our second topic, we're going to talk about pieces of pop culture that we once loved, but are no longer as enthralled with. And just so we're not all terribly depressed by the time we're through, we're also going to talk about pieces of pop culture that we've come around on, that we've come to appreciate over time. Gabe, let's start with you. All
right.
What's a piece of pop culture that you once loved but are no longer as enchanted by?
I think I would have to say, and this is like a blanket, just like casting the net wide. So like pop music and like rock and alternative and all that kind of stuff. I used to have like far greater a fondness for it mm-hmm. than I do now. Now I sort of equate it to when I was like a teenager, I really enjoyed like roller coasters, but I don't really enjoy them that much anymore. And so there's like, I feel like there's like a place in your life for it, you know, and then you kind of get over it,
yeah.
you know, and there's not as much room in my life now for angst,
yeah.
you know, and for that the kind of emotional drama that comes in a lot of like pop music and rock. And so just kind of slowly, you know, it's like phasing the majority of it out of my life.
Yeah, that's very similar to my answer, which is Nirvana. Nirvana was a band that I adored. Julianne can attest.
I can.
But somehow, like that, I so associate that band with the feelings that I had as a teenager and with feeling upset and isolated and angsty. And while the songs are still good, the melodies are still good, whenever I always feel really silly when I listen to Nirvana now.
Well, I feel the same way about them and about a lot of bands that I liked in high school.
I feel like
they just don't treat emotional subject matter with any kind of genuine, I don't know how to express this, but it's like the emotions are so overwrought. And whenever I remember a few years ago, actually, it was like 5 years ago now, I was really angry and I just wanted some angry music. And I put them on, and I was like, this just feels affected. This doesn't feel like anything resembling what my feelings are, or like, this doesn't feel true to me. And I couldn't listen to them after that pretty much ever again.
I don't know. I mean, but I so connected to that music when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I felt like he understood me so well. I don't feel like my feelings have grown over time or have deepened over time.
Really?
I don't think so. Well, I feel like my feelings, I feel less now in a lot of ways.
Well, I think you feel less intensely as you get older, but I think that your feelings become more based in a realistic understanding of the world. Like, when you're a teenager, it's so out of proportion. You know, things just aren't, you don't process things correctly.
Well, that's the thing that I was thinking about as well with a lot of that music. Now, it's not that things in my life aren't hard or you know, aren't still dramatic or this or that. But, you know, when you listen to that music, you're just kind of like, suck it up, buddy. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to, like, juxtapose that with would be, like, say, now the music that I'm trying to listen to more or explore more would be, like, more classical music, mm-hmm. and say, like, Mozart's Requiem, which is dealing with far more, it's still just music, but it's dealing with far more, far deeper and far more real emotions and experience. But it is, like, different in a way. It's not like, oh, I'm feeling sad, I'm going to go listen to the Mozart's Requiem.
Right.
You know, but it's just, like, sort of treats the issues in a more
serious and more, like,
even, well, the music, not necessarily the artist.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think with Mozart, you can kind of project whatever feelings you have onto that music, whereas grunge music and punk music, it is screaming at you what it means. There's no subtlety. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm being harsh because the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony was a few weeks ago, and I will admit that when I saw Joan Jett and Kim Gordon and St. Vincent get up there and sing Nirvana songs, I thought, like, there was a part of me that really, really enjoyed it. So I'm not saying that those songs aren't still great, but they just don't speak to me in the same way that they used to.
I have some other examples of popular culture.
Well, feel free to share.
Outgrew. So I had thought of the movie Trainspotting, and then while we were having this very podcast session, I've thought of the movie Ghost World.
Hmm.
But Trainspotting, you know, it's this film about these junkies in Scotland, and it starts off, it's like, cheese life, cheese a washing machine, cheese conformity or whatever. And, you know, like, 16-year-old me was like, yeah, screw conformity. Like, these people have it right. No, they don't. They're screwed up messes. They murder a baby. I mean, they don't murder a baby, but, like, they're negligent to the point that the baby dies.
Yeah.
Their lives are completely horrifying and in total chaos. I mean, he, like, has to go home and, like, stay with his parents because he's, you know, fallen into a toilet and, like, can't get off the stuff.
We've
and
all
it's
been
like,
there.
It's so sad. There's nothing in it to praise or look up to. But when I was a teenager, I thought that group was so cool.
I know.
You know, it somehow the, like, grim realities of, I mean, it does glamorize a life on heroin. And I was too stupid to really, you know,
right,
understand what I was seeing. But I really can't even fathom how much I liked it at the time for those reasons.
Yeah, that's definitely a great example of when I look back and go, what was I thinking? The movie's terrible. And not,
choose a car. Choose a white picket fence.
I want a car.
I know.
What's wrong with a washing machine?
Well, those white picket fence keep out solicitor.
The one thing I would say is I probably spent the entire rest of my life trying to get shoes as cool as his shoes in the movie.
That's true.
Like, he has really cool red sneakers.
And you didn't even fall into a toilet.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that's because, you know, I've gotten a job. I've been responsible. I realize that there are other ways to get shoes aside from heroin.
You chose that washing machine. I chose a washing machine a few years ago. It's a great washing machine.
Oh, I'm so jealous. Wow.
So last.
Yeah.
And then the other one was Ghost World, which I saw when I was, like, 13 and related to so hard because it's so angsty. And I watched it again, and I found that, like, Enid was the most bratty, awful, self-centered character. And I actually related a lot more to the Steve Buscemi character, the, like, old man that she toys with, because he was miserable. He was, like, a miserable old crank, and I was like, that's me right there. But, she was just, I thought she was really cool because of what she wore, and I was like, yeah, you know, people are stupid. And then once I was old enough, it was really clear that she was just really mature.
So my example is just generally Christopher Nolan movies. I don't know.
What?
Sorry, Gabe.
Sorry, Gabe, indeed.
I used to think Memento was a super freaking awesome movie. And now I look back and watch it and go, this is stupid. This is a stupid movie trick. And his movies, and what I hate about his movies so much is that they are so broody. And that's one thing that really, really appealed to me as a teenager. Go figure. That darkness, like that the mood
the
lighting.
Darkness within.
Yes. Like they're all so portentous and like they're just huge, tackling these huge themes. And when you get right down to it, they're all really simple movies that have this air of sophistication or importance to them. And now that I'm a little older, I think I'm able to recognize that. So, I guess I gather by talking to you guys that the answer to this question is no. But
no.
Have you ever met? I talk to people sometimes, and they love, if they decide that they're going to like something, they like it forever.
No,
you've never met anyone like that.
I mean, I feel like people, if people are really honest with themselves, you'd have to say that about, like, in our generation, say a lot of 80s movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, like, I didn't see, there were a lot of, like, you know, you'd say, like, seminal 80s movies that I didn't see until, like, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Top Gun, things like that. And you'll just have these people that just love them. Just love them.
Yeah.
Top Gun is amazing, but, like, it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
Right.
And I feel it. Some people won't acknowledge that. They're just like, Top Gun is awesome.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's awesomely hilarious, you know?
Yeah. It's awesome in that it's awful.
I will never say that, yeah, just okay. Because people will kill me, okay, if I ever said that.
I'm going to go on the record, even though I've never seen it.
No, okay. Well, now I'm going
to.
It's really, really funny.
Okay.
It's yeah. But, I mean, and so I can't call to mind, like, a specific example, but I know what you're saying. Like, people that will just love something,
yeah,
you know? But I think if they're actually honest with themselves, it's the nostalgia that gets...
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I do understand what you're saying. Like, when you saw the tributes to Nirvana, it did elicit feelings, you
yeah
know? And every once in a while, like, I'll hear a Nirvana song or you hear a Weezer song and you still like it,
yeah,
you know? But what I found is that tends to be more the lighthearted stuff that's not as dour and serious.
Yeah.
I do, you know, relate to that. It elicits
yeah
emotions, but you don't feel as
yeah
powerful about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there are things that I will love forever. Like, Julianne can also attest, I loved Hole.
Okay.
I still love Hole. I will always love Hole, even though that opinion becomes harder and harder to justify.
Wait, the band or the film?
The band.
Okay.
But it becomes harder and harder to justify that opinion as Courtney Love gets crazier and crazier, and there will always be a part of me that loves that music, whether I'm willing to acknowledge it or not.
And you know what? Liking things ironically.
Okay.
That seems like a young thing.
Well,
I feel like there's not enough time to fake like anything. It's
yeah
like, you know, there's not enough time, and also who cares? If you like something that's like not that popular, own it.
Just
you know
like
what?
It.
You like Hole.
And
do like Hole, damn it.
And if it gets popular, don't stop liking it just because it's popular now.
Yeah. You know what? I love Britney Spears. I don't care.
Okay,
I don't love her ironically.
No.
Well, I do find as I'm getting older, my tastes seem to be getting, like, Gabe is getting into Mozart. I'm getting back into the Spice Girls, you know? I feel like
back into the Spice Girls?
Well,
did you ever leave the Spice Girls?
There was a brief period where I left the Spice Girls where I thought I was above the Spice Girls. Alas, I was wrong.
Sad.
But I know.
I felt that way about the Harry Potter books. The sixth book came out when I was 16, and I was like, I don't care about Harry and his wizard friends. I'm a sophisticated adult woman. And then I bought it like 5 days later.
So, but to back to the question, do you feel like your tastes are getting more sophisticated as you get older? Or
no.
No?
Oh my God, no.
I would say hopefully.
Okay.
You know, and I'm trying, but more in the sense that I'm trying now to consume more.
Okay.
And so I'm not making, you know, like, oh, I'm not going to like that because it's not cool to like that, you know. And so I feel that I've become more sophisticated in that sense, that I'm not, like you said, not worried about as much about what other people think, you know, and just trying to find more art, you know, and consume art and see what speaks to me, what I think is good art, and exploring more what I think the definition of art is, you know, and all those kind of things. So I do feel that I'm becoming more mature in that sense.
Yeah. See, to me, I feel like my tastes have narrowed. Unfortunately, it's not a good thing. I feel like I was more open to exploring things, and I was really into finding new, interesting, experimental things. And now I just feel like I don't have the patience for it as I once did. But what's something that you initially wrote off or decided you didn't like, but then came back to it later and realized that you did like it? Gabe, let's start with you.
Okay. For me, it was The West Side Story.
Okay.
Okay. When I first saw it at probably like 7 or 8, I could not forgive these gang members for dancing all over the place in tights and ballet slippers. I had been promised or had been told that this was a movie about gangsters in New York. And, yes. And so when the opening scene started and they start dancing, mm-hmm. I was so furious. Mm. And it was years before I could acknowledge. And musicals aren't like my thing, but I do. There is a place in my mind where I can appreciate them. Mm-hmm. And so now I can watch West Side Story and not be horribly upset.
Yeah.
There's also the place in my mind that still remains horribly upset, but I feel like I have, you know, gotten over that.
Yeah. Musicals are definitely one area where I've totally come around. I think I loved them when I was a kid, but even West Side Story seemed really silly. They're tap dancing on the street? Like, shouldn't they be knifing each other? But I feel like I've totally come around. I was hesitant to buy into the whole, they're just living and then they're singing, and how do they all know the words to this one song? That's impossible. That wouldn't really happen. But now if you buy into that, the idea that people can just make up words off the top of their head and they're really brilliant, then there's so much pleasure to be had in musicals. So, when I was a kid, my parents used to force me and my brother to listen to standards, like Cole Porter music, and even like Harold Arlen music.
Good for your brain.
None of that poisonous rock and roll music. Bad influence. Well, naturally, all I wanted as a kid was to listen to that horrible,
hip-hop racket.
Exactly, yeah. So,
naturally,
as soon as I got a chance, I'd go and purchase rock and roll records. But as I've gotten older, I've now come to realize, as with most things, that my parents were absolutely right, and all that 50s pop music that they made me listen to, and early 60s pop music, and the country music that they made me listen to, it was all pretty awesome, and now I freaking love, you know, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. It's one of my favorite songs of all time. Wayward Wind, Patsy Cline. So
she's pretty good, I guess.
She's all right.
Hello.
Okay, well, I have one more confession on that front. When I first saw Double Indemnity, I thought it was really stupid.
What?
I know!
Dun, dun, dun!
What?
I know!
Girlfriend! Why?
Because I thought Fred McMurray was such a sleazeball, and I couldn't get past that. But I feel like that essence, that Fred McMurray essence, really, now that I'm older and I have some perspective, I realize that essence of Fred McMurray plays really well into this Walter hapless idiot who totally gets hooked on this horrible scheme of Barbara Stanwyck's. So I love Barbara Stanwyck. So naturally, I've come around completely, and Billy Wilder is my favorite director, And I now realize how sophisticated all of the dialogue is, and I now think it's a wonderful movie. It's probably perhaps among my favorites.
Perhaps your tastes are becoming more sophisticated after all.
Oh, dun, dun, dun.
Okay. Time for our last segment. As some very wise British ladies once said, all you need is positivity.
Oh, is that what we're doing?
Yes. All right.
So confused.
Don't worry about it.
You were clearly never a Spice Girl. Like in a troupe of Spice Girls.
Oh, no, no.
So here we are with our final note of positivity. Gabe, what's one piece of pop culture that you're feeling positive about?
Yes, share the colors of the world that inspire you.
This is not pop culture as is usually defined, but for this week, it's Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And I heard this really cool story about him. The one day he was walking down the street and some guy approached him claiming to be a distant relative in need of some cash. Mozart didn't have any on him at the time, so he ducked into a coffee shop, grabbed a piece of paper, and wrote a little sonata. Gave it to the guy and said, go to my publisher and he'll give you money for it.
Wow. I hope that story is true. I've heard a similar story about Pablo Picasso, how he would never pay for any meals in restaurants. He'd just write a check and his signature was worth more than the meal, so they'd just hold on to the check. Julianne, how about you? What's your final note of positivity?
My roommate and I have been playing a video graphic game called The Last of Us, which it's a zombie game. And, you know, I thought that the zombie genre was tired. I'm a little sick of it. I don't really care how people fare in the post-apocalyptic world with, like, reanimated corpses because it's ridiculous. But, oh my god, this game is great. It's really interesting. I mean, it does fall into a lot of video game tropes. Like, we're currently on a rescue mission where we've got to rescue our female sidekick and that kind of thing. But it's really, like, narratively very impressive. It feels like watching a pretty good movie, but you're, you know, playing all of the heroic active parts. So I've been enjoying that.
Awesome.
Would recommend it to anyone with a PlayStation 3.
So my note of positivity is, well, you guys are going to have to bear with me because I'm going to talk about Star Trek. As I've mentioned before on the podcast, I have been going through all of the Star Trek franchises. One of my prior notes of positivity was the final episode of The Next Generation. I've been going through Deep Space Nine. I'm almost finished, but I'm holding off the last few episodes. So I've recently started Voyager. Now, it's too early for me to say whether or not it's one of the better Star Trek franchises. I can't quite make that call. But I will tell you that Kate Mulgrew, as Captain Catherine Janeway, is amazing. And I primarily listen to Star Trek. I put it on when I'm doing other things. And Kate Mulgrew's voice is eerily similar to Katharine Hepburn's. So as I'm listening to Star Trek Voyager, it's almost like Katharine Hepburn is commanding a starship, and it's pretty much the
to
greatest.
To let go, and no man has gone before.
Is that a note of positivity?
Rust does engage.
Is that a note of positivity or a note of insanity?
I am so, either way, I feel great about it because Katharine Hepburn meets cheesy sci-fi. Oh my god. It's the best of both worlds, which is a Star Trek episode, by the way.
The best of both worlds.
Insane! Oh, goodness. So, set your phasers to stun and enjoy Kate Mulgrew as Catherine Janeway on Star Trek Voyager. She is ridiculously awesome. Plus, she's also one of my favorite characters on Orange is the New Black, which will no doubt be a note of positivity in the near future. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, season two.
It's coming out. It's coming out. Can't wait. Anyway, but Kate Mulgrew, you are awesome. Let's be friends. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Join us next week for our discussion of Sergei Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin. In the meantime, be sure to let us know what you thought of this episode. You can leave us a comment on our show page, flickswise.com. You can send us a message on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. We're on Twitter. We're on Tumblr. Come say hi. Until next time, Julianne, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Gabe, pleasure as always.
Likewise.
Arrivederci!